Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio.
Earth Explorers, thank you so much for waiting for the month of April to go by. I had to take the month off in order to do quite a bit of work to get the electric truck ready to ship to Europe. So I appreciate your patience. Thank you so much for your kind emails and your support. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and tonight we are live, May 1st, with Stories from the Road. Because I am on the road right now, not in my normal studio. But my producer, Don, is gracious enough to dial me in by cell phone. So I am on and live. And welcome back. This is Stories from the Road with Brooks Agnew on X Squared Radio, May 1st, 2011. I am on the road right now, but peacefully minding my own business, driving within the legal limits of the freeway. Heading back for southern Mississippi from the shop in Florida where we were preparing the electric truck to ship to Europe. All things are going well. Thank you so much for your patience for me not being around in April. We will fix everything on the website and everyone will know what's going on. But you that are listening live are now current with everything. Very, very high strangeness in the weather. Although the sun has been fairly stable, normally, in the month of April, we have about 180 tornadoes. In April, we have had over 800 tornadoes, and May has just begun. Historically, May is worse for tornadoes than April. Very high strangeness in the weather. However, if you've read the Ark of Millions of Years, you were prepared for it and already had your shelter ready to go. And this is just a prelude of things to come, not to be an alarmist, but to be empowering you to be able to get yourself prepared to go through the metamorphosis of the Earth for 2012. Also in the news, elections are coming up, and I want you to pay particular attention to the positions of the primary candidates as they ready themselves. Be aware that there are very powerful forces trying to gain control of the world at this time. Now, it's not as easy as you think. You would think that the New World Order is marching along unabated, but it is not, because many millions of you out there are becoming awake and aware. This is making it difficult for those that are trying to control the world. You already know what is happening. You already are empowered to position yourself and to listen to the vibrations and the thoughts of the universe. Not to be too strange out there, not to be too weird with the channeling and all of that. I'm just saying, from a physics point of view, there are energies that synergize with the dreams that you have put out in the future, and there are energies that do not. That makes you aware. That makes you empowered to be able to apply energy and intention to a future which you envision. As you know, there are about 7 billion realities on the Earth, the average of which is what we generally experience on this planet. Well, that average is beginning to shift because you are becoming aware of what's going on. And even more, you're becoming aware that you are an integral part in the creation of that future. I want you, If you haven't already got a copy of Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, you can get your copy by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com, and you can purchase the copy there. If you purchase there, as opposed to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Borders, Walden Books, etc., you will not only get the paperback signed, autographed by me, but you'll also get the audiobook for free as a download. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. You can share the book with someone who you love and who you want to be able to take control of their lives and be able to master the bounty of the universe into their lap. So that's out there for you, rememberingthefuturebook.com. I do have a guest tonight. Joe has agreed to come on the program. We have communicated by email for the past couple of months. He, like me, is aware of many of the forces that are out there working in the community, in the state, the nation, and in the universe. And he reports on it as well. We have never spoken together, but I have a great feeling that tonight, in a special Stories of the Road series of X Squared Radio, you are about to participate in some very high energy. Welcome to the program, Joe. How are you?
Hey, Brooks. Wonderful. And it's great to finally get a chat with you.
Yes, this is going to be great. I have a little bit of a distraction in the sense that I have a steering wheel in my hand and a gas pedal. It's not really a gas pedal. It's an air pedal underneath my right foot. But other than that, you have my undivided attention. Where should we begin?
Well, why don't we begin by talking about the biggest, most transparent lie that they're trying, that the New World Order group is trying to push down our throat, and that's the global warming issue. And I've been studying this, and I'm an engineer, so I've studied it from the scientific standpoint for probably 5 or 10 years. I started seriously researching it and writing about it 2.5 years ago when Obama started running for office and saying he was going to, you know, take our carbon use away from us. And my very first article was called Hoax of the Century, and it was actually posted by Alex Jones at InfoWars. I went on from there.
Wow.
And had, that was in April of 2009. I went on and had 25 articles posted at Climate Realist, and then I got on with Canada Free Press, and I had 60 articles posted there. I've been read into the Congressional Record, several of my articles. I've been on Drudge Report, Breitbart. Up until last May, I had 200,000 cross-links to my articles in over a dozen languages. So the Internet is our Gutenberg printing press, and it is freeing us from the monarchs and the monopolists. But they realize that.
Well, I think so too. As long as it stays free and open and unfettered and unthrottled, I think I agree with you. I think some of the evidence points to that most of the planets and Earth were warming up until around 1998 when the temperature leveled off. But what we have noticed is the extremes in the weather. The winters are much colder and the summers are much hotter, even though the average temperature hasn't changed in about 13 years. And it may even begin to be heading toward lower temperatures now that the sun has reactivated its solar cycles and is now filling our upper atmosphere with cosmic rays and thus sun blocking haziness in the high levels of the atmosphere, which is actually lowering the heat transfer from the sun to the Earth. But what is your evidence showing?
Well, weather and climate are a polynomial, which means you have a whole bunch of different variables, and carbon dioxide is such a low level that it shouldn't even be considered in the equation. As far as I'm concerned, atmospheric carbon dioxide is a complete non-player when you consider the other forces that are involved. I was on the Dennis Miller talk program, and the result of me writing all those articles, I've written over 100 articles in the last 2 years that have been posted at major websites, was that I was contacted by a group of scientists, and we wrote a book called Slaying the Sky Dragon, which is 8 international artists, engineers and scientists. We're from 5 different countries. Most of us have never met. 4 of them have PhDs. It's a very well-researched book that covers the climate issues. And I was invited to be the speaker for the group on Dennis Miller program March 10th and had a great interview with Dennis Miller in which I brought up three of the most glaring defects in global warming theory. One of those was thermal mass. And like I told Dennis Miller, if you can take a red hot BB and throw it in a swimming pool, it'll, you know, reach the same temperature as the swimming pool rather quickly, but the BB's not going to warm the pool up much. And that's the effect of thermal mass. What humans have done in the last, and actually we never do more than about 4 years, service time in the air anyway, because when you put carbon dioxide into the air, it's either absorbed by the ocean and becomes calcium carbonates in the forms of reefs, shells, and skeletons, or it is absorbed by plants, held temporarily, and becomes dirt. And dirt and calcium carbonate both weigh 125 pounds per cubic foot. What humans have currently in the atmosphere total is about 28 gigatons, which is 28 tons with nine zeros behind it. But if you divide by 125 pounds per cubic foot, that means we've put less than 3 cubic miles of microscopic dust in the air. And this dust is virtually non-toxic. When they were doing the studies for a fire suppression system for the space shuttle and the space station, they tested carbon dioxide, and that's the system that they chose because in concentrations of less than 80,000 parts per million, it has no measurable side effects. Atmosphere currently has 380 parts per million. So I was riding back and forth with our group of Sky Slayers, which at this point we've added another half dozen guys. So we've got 15, 20 PhDs worldwide that are riding with us and helping each other do calculations. And one of them asked me a couple of days ago, said, well, you know, I think your BB analogy is a very effective tool, but actually, how many, you know, how big a swimming pool are we talking about? And so I thought, well, let's figure this out. I had measured a package of BBs. I think it was 2,500 BBs in a pint carton and calculated that a million BBs would be 21 gallons. And this was just to illustrate what Al Gore was saying, that we currently had, that the humans were going to add 4 parts per million in carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. And most people don't know what a part per million is. And I said, well, it's equivalent to adding 4 BBs to 21 gallons full of BBs. And most people can understand that. Normal trash can size is 21 gallons. But by coincidence, the average residential swimming pool in the United States is about 18,000 gallons. And so if you start doing the conversion, turns out that what one BB, if you want to convert the 3 cubic miles of carbon dioxide that the 28 gigatons actually relates to the 259 trillion cubic miles of Earth, then what you're actually talking about is one BB is going to warm up 86,000 swimming pools of 21,000 gallons apiece. And if you believe that, that's pretty far-fetched.
Yeah, I like that analogy. The realization, or at least the mean measurement, that the average temperature of the Earth did in fact rise up until 1998 is kind of the wagon that all these political machines that wanted to raise literally trillions of dollars to try to control an economy and actually fund a political machine
and create a false commodity market.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The carbon
exactly.
exchange.
But it was designed to create a funding machine for them, but the force that was causing the Earth to warm up until that time wasn't human-oriented. It came
Absolutely
from another
not.
Source.
Yes, yes.
It came from another source out in the galaxy somewhere.
Right. I agree with you 100%. The planet has gone through enormous fluctuations in the past. There's the thing, the Milankovitch cycle over the last 450,000 years where it's spent approximately 100,000 years in a deep ice age cycle, and then about 10 to 12,000 years in what's called an interglacial period. We're at the end of an interglacial period. We could very easily enter another ice age, and we're not sure exactly what those mechanisms are, but my articles do have quite a bit of research on that, which and present some very interesting theories. Now, another item that further illustrates the folly of the global warming group is that they don't understand electromagnetic transmission. What they're claiming is that the Earth warms up during the day through full spectrum absorption of sunlight, and then at night it radiates long wave radiation back into space. Well, what they don't tell you is that radiation that's leaving the planet is electromagnetic. It's infrared. It moves at the speed of light. And so several of the members of our Slaying the Sky Dragon group did some calculations, and it turns out the maximum number of impacts that you can hit with carbon dioxide atoms with a lapse rate of about a billionth of a second per molecule is going to cause a delay of about 20 milliseconds. So what they're talking about, global warming, you're going to reach the same temperature. If you had zero carbon dioxide in the air, you'd reach that temperature 20 milliseconds quicker. So warming is lasting for 20 milliseconds, but then we actually refine that number. What happens is when the infrared beam hits a carbon dioxide molecule, it vibrates, which causes a slight shift in the re-radiated energy, and that shifts it to a longer wavelength, and after about two or three impacts, then there is no longer any absorption capability because you're outside of the bandwidth for carbon dioxide.
Simply That's right. Stated, it'll be absorbed by other molecules that have a different residence.
It actually becomes invisible to every molecule in the atmosphere. It's no longer visible to water vapor, nitrogen, oxygen, or carbon dioxide, so it passes freely out of the atmosphere. Now we're talking a dwell time of 5 milliseconds, and that's the extent of global warming. You're going to reach the same temperature, you're just going to reach it 5 milliseconds, which is 5,000th of a second sooner. And so warming is delaying that by 5,000th of a second. If that's something you can get your knickers in a twist over, you got a lot worse problems in your life than me.
Well, we have a gross amount of energy that is striking the Earth from space. Some of it comes from the sun, and some
right.
of it comes in the form of other frequencies that are further
yes,
out
sir.
Of the galaxy. Some are long-wave gravitational waves, and some are very high-speed X-rays. But that gross amount of energy, some of it sticks, and some of it is reflected back out into space, that being called the albedo, or the reflectivity of the planet.
Right.
So
right.
if all of the land mass, for instance, is covered with snow, it reflects most of that energy back out into space. If it's covered in greenery, which, by the way, green is the biggest absorber of infrared wavelengths, then it absorbs into the planet. Between us and all that energy is the atmosphere, and it can be clear or it can be somewhat hazy. If it's hazy, especially in the upper atmosphere, ionosphere, stratosphere, those particles absorb the energy in an area of the planet that's about 60 to 80 below zero. So there's really no net warming of the Earth because that radiation never hits the Earth. It hits the blanket of insulation we have around the Earth called the upper atmosphere. The energy that actually strikes the Earth and absorbs into the planet and thus can reflect out into space is a net amount of energy that makes it through all of those obstacles to be able to strike the Earth. Most of the short wavelengths are filtered out, UVC, and a good portion of the UVB. It's the longer wavelengths on up into infrared, somewhere around 800 to 1,000 nanometers, that actually strikes the Earth. Now, the fact that we did increase in temperature up to 1998 leads me to believe, and by the way, all the planets in the solar system that were measured, I won't say all the planets because we didn't measure them all, but all the planets that we measured also increased in temperature during that same period of time. So some force of energy outside our planet, maybe in our solar system, maybe in our galaxy, was responsible for that net gain in energy of the Earth, not humans. Now that's ended. We're now going through weather extremes, very, very cold and very, very hot in the summertime. But the net the average temperature of the Earth has leveled off. And just as Joe is saying, we could very rapidly dive into an ice age, and it doesn't take 100 years to get there. We could get there in 10 years or 5 years with the right weather conditions, right?
And with the right space conditions. One of my principal theories has been that the amount of Earth fission has been grossly underestimated. This was estimated up until 2005 as being somewhere in the range of 6 terawatts. And then they did the Camland experiment, and so all of a sudden they had a whole lot more particles coming out of the center of the Earth than they expected. And so they did a tenfold increase. Well, if you're off by an order of magnitude, then you don't really have a clue what you're talking about. And I've written a new article indicating that they're probably off by 3 or 4 magnitudes, and it's posted at faux scienceslayer.com. faux scienceslayer.com. And in that article, I mentioned that you have undersea vents, which are actually working like refrigerators. We're blowing extremely high pressure hot gases into the ocean, and they instantly disappear. There's no bubbles. Well, what they're doing is they're phase changing into a liquid at that point, because they're under high pressure and low temperature, and they're reaching a saturation point with the ocean, and this creates a denser water, and it also cools the water. So the water then flows down into the bottom of the ocean basin, which is far deeper than the 3,000 to 7,000 foot depth rift lines, which ring all of our oceans. And at that point, then it starts warming up, and as the water warms up, it rises up and it gets stirred up because of this downdraft from the vent location, and you create these wells, and as it's coming up, then it's released. And if you'll notice, anybody that's ever been scuba diving, and anybody that's paid any attention to underwater photography, whales are covered with bubbles. If you're underwater, you can wave your hand in the water and bubbles will just appear out of nowhere. And the reason why is because the oceans are absolutely at their saturation limit. And when those bubbles appear and they come up to the surface and they evaporate, they take heat. And the same thing that the sun does. The oceans provide an enormous cooling system. Just like your home refrigeration system, you have an evaporator, a compressor, and a condenser. And when it evaporates off the surface, it removes heat, and that goes up in the atmosphere, and then it condenses, it releases heat, and then it drops back down as cool water, which absorbs more heat. And then they're turning around and telling you that water vapor is one of the greenhouse gases that's keeping the planet warm. Well, I'm sorry, if you can calculate the magnitude of CO2 warming, and it ends up being a tenth of a degree centigrade, and you calculate the magnitude of water vapor cooling, and it ends up being 50 degrees centigrade, there's no reason to even consider the carbon dioxide.
Yeah, so I couldn't agree with you more. Overhead above the United States, and I think those people in Missouri and Kentucky and Tennessee would not argue with this at all. Above us, every single day, flows a river full of billions of gallons of water. It flows around our planet like a giant sky river. And that's what really brings life to the planet. Sometimes a little too much life, and it floods our rivers. But that amount of water vapor is totally driven by the amount of heat that is striking the oceans. It allows that water to then jump into the air. It allows the air to be able to hold it and get up to a relative humidity or a dew point that's high enough that water vapor can get up into the jet stream and then move around the planet. That's the river of water that's over us all the time. If it weren't there, we would be one heck of a desert planet.
Oh, we would have no climate. We'd be the moon, which has no atmosphere and no water also. To put some numbers to this, you can take 1 gram of ice at 0 degrees centigrade, which is 32 Fahrenheit, and it requires 80 calories of heat input in order to become 0 degree centigrade water. So just to go from ice to water takes 80 calories. Then to go from 0 degree water to 100 degree water takes 100 calories. And then it takes 540 calories to go from 100 degree centigrade water to 100 degree centigrade steam. So these changes, it's latent heat of vaporization and the latent heat of condensation, latent heat of solidification. Those phase changes transfer enormous amounts of energy. And that's what's completely left out of the climatology classes, and it's left out of the IPCC, which is the International Panel on Climate Control, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Control. And that's the reason why their science is so totally defective. Now, one other thing that I've explored quite a bit, and that's the Earth, on the Earth's fission, is the magnitude of the Earth's fission is based on uranium being 4 parts per million. Okay, if you've got a planet of 259 trillion cubic miles, and it has an average temperature of at least 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, that is not residual heat of origin from 4 billion years ago, and that has absolutely nothing to do with absorbed sunlight. That is fission energy that's being created every day by the Earth.
That's right.
When one uranium atom breaks down, it releases 2 million times the energy of one molecule of TNT, which is why nuclear bombs are measured in megatons of nuclear reactant to megatons of TNT. And so,
well, when uranium naturally decays, and by the way, there's immeasurable amounts of uranium in the core of the Earth.
That
when uranium breaks down, there's a whole chart of nuclides that covers the daughters of uranium, one of which is radon, which I'm sure the listening audience is familiar with. It has a very short half-life. You breathe
3.8
in that particle.
Days.
Yeah, 3.8 days. So it's probably going to decay in your body. It's an alpha decay, which is tissue destroying, and that's why you end up getting lung cancer by breathing in radon. But the other daughters are thorium, sodium-40, and some of these have very long half-lives, like 12,500 years. Yes, they're radioactive, but they're not really active radioactive. So, you know, there's a whole plethora of how to look at this. Yes, it's a lot of energy, but some of it releases in a very short amount of time naturally, and some of it in a very long amount of time naturally. Uranium isn't really what's used to make nuclear bombs naturally. They have to enrich it. That is to say, they have to accelerate and slam extra neutrons onto it to build up its molecular weight and make it much more radioactive in terms of particles. Sort of like having a mouse trap on every tile in a room with a ping pong ball on the spring. That's pretty active. So if one of those mouse traps goes off, it's going to cause a chain reaction. But what we do to make bombs out of it is we take an extra 55-gallon drum of ping pong balls and we dump it in the room, which makes it a lot more reactive. And that's how we get something explosive instead of something merely radioactive.
And to say that radon has a half-life of 3.8 days is not really illustrative to a lot of people, but let's put it this way. If you had a pound of radon, in 21 days, you'd have an eighth of an ounce just by natural decay. The fact
exactly.
that there is any radon accumulating in basements and caves anywhere in the world indicates that there's an enormous amount of daily production of radon. That's the only way you can have it. Now, the implication of that is that if you're producing radon, what you're also doing is producing the other 12 different daughter reactions that can happen from uranium, and ultimately you'll end up being producing what's called elemental atoms. When the Russians drilled their Kola website, which is in Kola Peninsula near the Baltic Sea, they drilled down to 40,000 foot level, and they were reaching ground ambient temperatures of 350 degrees Fahrenheit, and they were encountering water. They were having to use oil as a drilling fluid because the temperatures would have boiled water off, and so they were using oil to drive their drill head, and it kept getting water into it that diluted the oil and flashed the steam, and they ended up not being able to drill anymore. And the Russians theorized that the only thing that could be doing that was that the water that they were encountering at that temperature and that pressure had to have been elemental water, which means that as the uranium breaks down, your 92 neutron proton pairs can make 92 hydrogen atoms, or they can make 46 helium atoms, or they can make 16 carbon atoms, or they can make 12 oxygen atoms, roughly.
Correct.
And so what that means is the planet is producing the feedstock for hydrocarbon every day. And that's why the ocean floors are full of methane calcites. That's why the Arctic and Antarctic are full of methane hydrates, because the planet is outgassing methane constantly, and in those locations below the ocean where it's 0 degrees and it turns into a ice crystal as it's being released, and in the Arctic and Antarctic it's cold enough that the methane is captured. Otherwise, it comes out, goes into the atmosphere, it's broken down by the constant radiation from space and from the sun, and then we don't actually see it because it actually becomes hydrogen and carbon atoms. But methane is being produced, and that's why oil is being produced every day. I wrote an article back in September called Fossil Fuel is Nuclear Waste, and had that article posted at Canada Free Press. I live in the Houston area, so I sent it to a few of my buddies that work in the oil patch. That article had 11,000 cross-links in one day. 2 weeks later, John McLaughlin, that used to do the McLaughlin Report on PBS, wrote an article called Sustainable Oil Production. His was posted at American Thinker, which is a little bit bigger website, and his had 40,000 cross-links in 2 days. So the word's getting out. We don't have peak oil. Peak oil is the second big lie after global warming. And
Right. The idea behind abiotic oil is that oil is not dinosaurs. It is not ancient forests. It may have been ancient algae beds that broke down into it. But when methane is CH3, and long-chain hydrocarbons are usually alkanes, which are full saturated hydrocarbons in chains, which is just compressed methane allowed to age. And that's what oil is. Now, are we pumping it out faster than the Earth can make it? Maybe, in certain cavities. But if you leave it to itself for 50 years and then go back, you've probably filled up the cavity again.
And if you're not extracting it, then it's going to end up outgassing in a way that will be more environmentally damaging. Amazingly
right.
enough, the Lawrence Livermore lab 2 weeks ago released a press report saying the Earth can generate its own methane independent of fossil deposits. So absurd.
Right.
That they're
normally
finally...
when we see methane, we think that it's the result of respiration. That's when we see methane, like when something rots or when bacteria is involved, you end up with methane. That is one of the sources. But the other source is this chemical generation, which is not biological in nature. It's more like, I guess you could call it the respiration of planet Earth.
I would go so far as to claim there is no bio or actually fossil fuel created petroleum on the whole planet. What we have is fossil fuel signatures that are picked up because of the soil deposits, like your peat, where your coal deposits are. Those are going to have a carbon imprint from the interred sediments, but that doesn't mean that that's the origin of the main hydrocarbon family that's in that reserve capacity. But,
yeah, I could agree with that. I could agree with that. But there is something fundamentally destabilizing, somewhat primitive, about the idea of shoveling it into your gas tank and burning it. There are better uses for oil than gasoline.
Well, we could certainly increase the efficiency, and I've got an auto design that we can get to in a few minutes, an internal combustion engine technology that's been suppressed for about 25 years. But, well, we're finishing up on the green energy scam. I think we ought, it's important to explain a few things about solar cells, which happen to be another one of the big hoaxes that they're creating, that there is green energy. The way the majority of the solar cells operate now, and I've got an article on this called The Green Prince of Darkness, which is also posted at Canada Free Press. It's a great article, well-researched. The typical solar cells that are utilized now, and you can use more expensive rare elements, but you know, all you're doing is driving up the cost for a minor increase in efficiency, and so the basic cost ratio doesn't change at all. What you're doing is you take a silicon sheet, which is nothing but a host. The silicon is actually inert to the sunshine that's being involved, and then you impregnate on that some phosphorus and some boron atoms. This gives you, the borons give you one extra electron, the phosphorus give you one less electron, and when the sun hits that, it excites the boron and releases an electron. But that electron leaves the solar cell as a direct current, and it goes somewhere else, and it doesn't come back. So what you're basically doing is molecular erosion, and you have a total life of less than 22 years. You take a solar cell, you put it out in the sun, and it will produce a pretty steady stream of electricity over the first 20 years of life. The last 2 years of life, it drops off to almost nothing. And then you end up with something that is nothing but junk. But in the total process of its electrical production life, it produces less energy than it takes to mine, refine, and produce a solar cell. So it's much like ethanol. You get 80,000 BTUs per gallon of ethanol, but it takes you 90,000 BTUs of fertilizer, water, distillation process to produce it. So why are we thinking this is a green energy? It takes more to produce it.
Well,
than
you're talking about ethanol that's produced from corn, because that's the way it's currently made, from the sugars in the seed. But
right.
Cellulosic ethanol, especially the first harvest of it, I'm not talking about the enzymatic ethanol, but cellulosic ethanol is a net gain. But I don't think it's any good to put it in gasoline anyway, because you
don't get
energy back out of it that way. But if you use the ethanol in an esterification reaction with a fatty acid, like, say, canola oil or used fryer oil, then you get something called biodiesel, and now you have about a 2.9-to-1 return on energy investment.
And that's what it's all about. It's doing things in an efficient manner that are compatible with our other technologies. If you're putting ethanol in a fuel tank and you're burning out every lawnmower engine in the country every 2 years and you have to keep replacing those, that's a cost cycle that really needs to be considered. And I think that this is actually being promoted by people who have a deviant, mindset. And they're actually more concerned with destroying internal combustion engines than they are in improving the environment. A perfect example is the low-sulfur diesel. You're burning out diesel engines that used to have a 500,000-mile life in less than 150,000 miles because you're losing the laborosity of the sulfur that was in the diesel fuel. Meanwhile, China's building coal-fired plants with no sulfur controls on it, and the ocean is getting elemental sulfur dioxide released into the ocean, and that's where the majority of the atmospheric carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide come from anyway, is the ocean. And we have no control over
right.
the Earth's emission
rate.
And if
you go to cities like Shanghai, which is a city of 30 million people with nothing but coal-fired power plants around it, the glass on the high-rise hotels is so etched from acid rain, you can't see out of it.
And those are brand new hotels, my friend.
Exactly. Those are brand new hotels. That's not the old buildings. The old buildings are even worse. And by the way, when these diesel drivers want to preserve their engines, they go to the truck stops. After they spend $4.05 a gallon for diesel fuel, then they spend $20 more on an additive to put into the fuel to put the lubricity back in it. That is biodiesel. They're pouring a gallon of biodiesel into a 50-gallon tank of diesel fuel to put the lubricity back into it. And it costs $10 a gallon. You can produce biodiesel, B100 biodiesel, for less than $3 a gallon, and you get a 3-to-1 energy return on your investment. And yet, we are not building biodiesel plants. We are not growing our fuel. We are burning low-sulfur petroleum for that fuel.
Well, it would be nice if we had a world that was governed by sanity and honesty. That would be a refreshing change. Now, back to, I know you've got an electric automobile, and I think you're working on an electric truck at this particular point. I am not a big advocate of battery storage electric vehicles because you have the same problem that you have with the solar cells. You've got a maximum 400 cycle recharge on virtually any kind of battery material, and then they have to be recycled, and then you start figuring those costs in, then it ends up being pretty prohibitive from that standpoint also.
The battery technology now, we're up to a little over 2,000 recharges. And by the way, this is a recharge from complete exhaustion, which most people don't drive to complete exhaustion. So these batteries are somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 cycles of average driving, which is, you know, about 10 years. The batteries have an effective life of about 8 years. And we do have battery technology coming down the pike that has useful life of 30 years, but we haven't seen them in production yet. We don't expect to see them for 2 or 3 more years. The full cost per mile to drive an electric vehicle with battery replacement is still cheaper than gasoline right now. We do the calculation every day.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good news that wasn't in my research stack. My article, Green Prince of Darkness, did go into the weight and replacement costs and cycle life on a Prius, for example, because
that's a sodium zinc battery, which is one of the least efficient batteries out there and one of the most toxic.
I think it's a nickel hydride, but the nickel is extremely environmentally damaging to process also, which nobody wants to tell
you. Exactly. Now we're to lithium iron phosphate, and very soon we will be getting into lithium titanium, which is a very stable, very environmentally friendly battery. These batteries, you could throw them in a fire, you could drill a hole in them, you could, lithium iron phosphate is extremely stable. It's nothing like the lithium polymer that has been the culprit in many a battery fire around the planet using lithium.
Yeah, and your laptops. Well, my personal feeling is that the best solution for personal transportation is going to be a hybrid, but we need to have a vast improvement in the internal combustion engine. And that improvement was created in Australia, and I read about it in Popular Science probably in the early 80s. And it was a patent where the guy realized that a two-stroke engine has a typical two-stroke, for people who are not familiar with it, has a piston that fires on every rotation. And as the piston is coming down on rotation, it closes off either a rotary valve or reed valves in the crankcase, and it uses the downward motion of the piston to pressurize the crankcase. Then as the piston reaches the bottom, there's a port on one side that allows the hot exhaust gas to blow out, and then almost simultaneously a port opens on the other side where this compressed air from the crankcase can shoot across the cylinder. You get poor scavenge with that engine, which means the top of the cylinder doesn't get good mixing. You have a power loss because of the power that it takes to compress the crankcase air in order to get it to evacuate when you reach the bottom. There's a whole bunch of problems with two-stroke engines, but they do have a lot of usability because you can run them in any particular direction, which is why they're great for chainsaws. You know, and they're lightweight and they're very cheap to produce. But this engineer in Australia back in the early 80s realized that the diesel fuel injectors off of a large diesel engine would provide the adequate air supply for a two-stroke engine without having a pressurized crankcase and without having any intake ports at the base of the cylinder. And what you're doing in that case is that you would inject air and fuel into the top of the cylinder right as you hit the bottom of your power stroke, which would evacuate the whole cylinder from the top, so you'd have a complete clean air charge. Then as the piston comes up, you inject the fuel right as you get close to the top dead center like you do on a normal injection engine, and you would fire. The advantage to this is you could skip every other cycle very easily, and you'd have a 50% displacement change. On a two-cylinder engine, you could operate one bank of that two-cylinder engine very easily just by not compressing air and blowing it into that cylinder. Where on a typical engine now, where you have a multi-displacement engine like the V8 truck engines that shift between 4 and 6 and 8 cylinders depending on load, or Honda's Odyssey van that shifts by knocking out individual cylinders, this would just... It has no involved valve train mechanisms and no other fancy requirements. You just don't inject air in the cylinder that's not running. And then you don't inject air every other cycle. And so basically you've got a variable displacement engine. You could probably skip under light load conditions to every third rotation and have a 6-cycle instead of a 4 or 2-cycle engine. So what you'd have is a 500cc engine that could produce 100 horsepower, or you could easily switch it to an 86cc engine by operating every third power stroke on one bank of the cylinders only, and have a 16-horsepower engine. So you have complete flexibility for what your engine power requirement is for your load. And then you hook it up to a generator and you provide the generator, so you reduce your battery capacity. And the advantage is then you've got extended range, you've got real quick refuel, you've got a super cheap engine to build and operate, super lightweight. If you're getting 200 miles per gallon, you only need a 2.5-gallon gas tank. And so you've reduced all these loads. I've got a car design that's also posted at my Faux Science Slayer website, and it explains this engine and it explains the type of hybrid automobile that I designed 20 years ago but could not get any traction because of the control of the media. So anyhow.
Yeah, I know. I get that as well. Fortunately or unfortunately, fuel prices are high enough now, and there's been a positively vacuous supply of affordable alternative fuel or electric vehicles by the major car makers. And that's for a couple of reasons. It's not necessarily the oil companies that are telling the car companies you can't produce these more efficient vehicles. It's because largely there's no win for the major car makers. And we've explained this a couple of times on this program before, but the bottom line is this. An engine like Joe was talking about, or an electric motor that's very efficient, with a storage ability so that you can, for instance, charge your vehicle up with cheap or even close to free electricity at night when the power plants are idling, and then drive it during the day, the 30 or 40 miles you're going to drive it to and from work or school or shopping or soccer games or whatever, and thus become a virtually zero net gain or net additive to the pollution of the planet. It takes less parts, which means it takes less people to put this together, and every vehicle that would be built would displace a current internal combustion engine they already make. So there's no win for them. It would be like, well, let's not make this anymore and make this. And by the way, it's going to cost us $400 million in tooling, and we have to build a new plant to do it. I'm sorry. There's no motivation to do that, people. If electric vehicles and pollution-free vehicles are going to hit the market, they have to come from independent companies. They cannot come from the major car makers.
that they're locked into the inertia of their 100-ton stamped steel presses, and that's the technology of the past, and they're like the buggy whip industry. They're not going to be able to change to incorporate the new technologies. And that's where free thinkers and entrepreneurs are going to be able to open up some doors. The problem that we face is that we've got a monopolistic power structure which has dominated the Western world for the last at least 150 years. And I've got another article that was posted at Canada Free Press called "I'll Take Some E Pluribus, But Hold the Unum." And that exposes the monopolists who took turns pumping and dumping first Edison, then Westinghouse, and then Tesla, and how they managed to create industries for these guys, and then they would create shortages, and they would create banking problems, and blah, 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 and bankrupt them until they owned every one of their patents. Edison had 1,000 patents. They managed to steal every one of them. Westinghouse had 200 patents. They stole every one of them. Tesla had 50 patents. They stole every one of them. If you ask somebody who invented radio, they'll say, oh, Marconi. Marconi stole a patent from a Russian and used his first radio set in England to get an illegal patent in England. He was a marquise. He was part of the upper class from Italy, and he was just selected because he had the most plausibility by having a little bit of science background that he could possibly have invented something. But they created a whole team of scientists around him to steal patents, and Tesla's patent for variable frequency radio transmission and receiving had already been approved by the U.S. Patent Office before Marconi ever even applied for a patent. And then they withheld the Tesla patent until Marconi had 2 years to get his perfected, and then they turned around and gave Marconi a Nobel Prize. It's absolutely absurd. But this is the way these people operate. We're dealing with a group of extremely evil monopolists and monarchs who rule the world, and they just want to continue ruling the world and finish us off. It's absolutely insane. But we can move on.
I couldn't agree more, and that's what we see. We see $3 trillion sucked out of our capital market and dumped into what they call the capital support market, and we see companies like GE who end up with several $100 million interest-free, and then 30 days later, we see the CEO of GE appointed as the new head of economic recovery by Barack Obama, and then 6 months later, we see GE post record profits of over $8 billion. All of this ties together, people. We are here to connect the dots for you. But
that doesn't take away
the reality, Joe, that companies like ours and yours and others, we have one thing they don't. We have customers. Thousands of them, hundreds of thousands of them. And in today's free market, you can find an independent investor, and there are lots of billionaires out there, and there are even more 100 millionaires out there, and there are even more multimillionaires out there. And it doesn't take very much money these days, because there are contract manufacturers out there who are starving to death. It doesn't take very much to get these ideas into manufacturing and onto the market before a very hungry populace who are willing to buy them. And that's going to be the new economy of this millennia.
Yes, after they finish bankrupting themselves, which the odd thing is they are driving themselves off the cliff first. They think that they're only taking the lemmings off the cliff, but they've actually done more to destroy themselves. I do have a series of articles under the tab Faux History at my Faux Science Slayer website, and it explains a lot of the incidents that led up to World War II. U.S. Capitol actually built the German miracle. We intentionally denied credit to the Weimar Republic. We drove up the inflation. This was another one of the monopolist pump and dumps. Then they turned around when Hitler took office and he said he was going to outlaw labor unions, and they started a massive investment. Over $100 million of U.S. capital flowed into Germany from major U.S. corporations that did not invest in America to get us out of the Depression. They invested in Germany because they had guarantees that they were going to get a high return and that there was going to be no labor strikes that to affect their production. And then there was a letter sent by the U.S. ambassador, and I've got it in my article, but I don't have it handy right now, that said that 100 U.S. corporations had each invested over $1 million apiece in Germany, and they were told it was going to be a five-year investment. In 1938, they couldn't get their money out of the country. Well, what we've done is the same thing with China. They tell you China owns our debt. They own $1 trillion worth of debt. What they don't tell you is that we've invested $10 trillion of your 401k in Chinese industry, and the deal was you got to buy $1 of treasury for every $10 we invest in your rotten socialist slave state economy. And so we've created a monster over there that looks like they have control of our debt, but actually we're 10 times more invested in them than they are in us. And now they can take claim.
Well, the truth is, the only thing they can do is buy U.S. debt. It is actually illegal for China and Chinese businessmen to invest in American businesses.
Well, why do they have to invest when they can steal all of our intellectual property for free? Because we're not going to enforce any of our intellectual property rights.
You're exactly right. The companies are going to China because the labor rates are free, real estate is practically free, and then what happens is when they go to the trade shows in Singapore or Brazil, they see their own products in the booth next door made by the Chinese company that they've been doing business with. And it looks just like their, and all the intellectual property belongs to China. I know this for a fact because it happened to me.
And these are good communists, and like they've always said, when the last capitalist is hung, he will be hung by the rope that he made himself. And so I have no sympathy
for
these monopolists that are bankrupting us, thinking that they're going to be able to buy America back 10 cents on the dollar, because if they kill this golden goose, there will be no future golden goose. There will be nothing but the gulags of slave states worldwide, and it will not produce the good society that we're capable of and that all of us are thinking of and that we know is capable within our human grasp at this point. So,
one of the things that you notice when you go to China, and I don't mean when you go to the major cities like Beijing or China or to Shanghai or Hong Kong, but you get out into the industrial complexes, into Jiangsu City, which is one of the biggest industrial complexes in the world, and you will see multi-million square foot buildings, one after the other, after the other, after the other, mile after mile after mile of industrial parks, and nobody is there. These buildings are completely empty. Nothing but a slab, windows, and a sign on the outside. Thousands of them.
Yeah, and the other thing that's not known is that Chinese have about a 40% default rate on their internal loans. That's another very closely guarded secret, is how horrible their actual internal economy is. They put up this false front and they control the currency rates and make it appear that they're a lot more successful than they are. If we could shift over to some other things.
Sure.
I had written 60 articles on global warming, and I just got absolutely bored to tears with it. And there was another little pet project that always bothered me from the time that I was a freshman in college, and that was the Big Bang Theory. It just never made sense to me how the universe could be expanding and could be expanding at the particular rate that it would, and where would the energy come from to allow for that, and what was on the other side of the expansion, and blah, 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 blah. So I started writing a series of articles at Canada Free Press, and the first one was called let's see. Gosh, I don't have my list of articles here, and I hate to misquote the title.
While you're thinking of that, let me make an announcement to the Expert Radio listeners that are out there. We're at the top of the first hour. We're just going to continue straight on through, no break. But I want to make sure that you know the phone lines are open now for the next 2 hours. So if you want to call in, go to xsquaredradio.com or go to bbsradio.com, channel 2, and you'll find the phone numbers there for you to call in. The lines are now open. So the producer will go ahead and let us know we have a call. And if you have questions or comments, feel free to join us on xsquaredradio.com. Your last name's Houston?
Olson, O-L-S-O-N.
Olson, I've got it. Joe Olson, author of numerous articles on various scientific subjects. The first hour went by in 5 minutes. If you missed it, I'm so sorry. But we do have 2 more hours of X Squared Radio. We do explore the mysteries of the universe here. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. This is Stories from the Road because right now I'm driving at, well, just under the speed of sound. And, I'm doing the entire show by cell phone. So if the sound quality isn't the normal studio quality that you normally get on X Squared Radio, I make no apologies. Because we are making use of the airwaves tonight and bringing you the May 1st issue of X Squared Radio. So now we're back to it. Phone lines are open. Continue, Joe.
Okay, I just remembered what I had a senior moment there. I think they're called a brain fart. Anyhow, I just remembered the title of my first article about Big Bang, and it was called Big Bang Rebuttal, which actually is the same title that Stephen Hawking wrote a book about. And I didn't know that. I don't Google every title before I write an article. And so I didn't know that he'd previously used that one or could have found another one. But surprisingly enough, I topped him on Google list for months afterwards. After I wrote that article, I wrote one called, The Cure for Cosmology's Peptic Ulcer. And, that kind of explored those two Australian scientists who, discovered the cure for peptic ulcers and were barred for 30 years from explaining it to the world, and then finally got a Nobel Prize for it. And then I wrote a couple more articles on and found a web posting where Hubble had an interview in 1936 in Time magazine in which he stated that right now we're looking through a 100-inch Hooker telescope and we can see 2.5 billion light years in the past, and what we're seeing is light that's moving at 25,000 miles per second. He said, when we get a 4-time increase in light by going to the 200-inch Palomar, Mount Palomar telescope, we will be able to see 4 times further, and we will see galaxies that are 10 billion light years away and moving at 100,000 miles per second, which is greater than half the speed of light, at which point everybody will know that this is completely absurd. The universe cannot be expanding. Well, I got an email from a reader, and he said, Olson, somebody's already thought of that. And here I am, I've already written 5 articles about how stupid the Big Bang Theory is and that the universe is, instead of expanding, it's rotating. And somebody says, no, guess what, somebody else has already said that. And I thought, well, great, now I look like the world's biggest idiot. So he gives me a link, and I go to the website, and sure enough, 1949, a Princeton mathematician named Kurt Gödel did the calculations using Einstein's original relativity theory, and according to Einstein, the universe cannot be static. It must either be expanding, contracting, or rotating. Gödel said, well, I can make it rotate if we have these two additional factors in the equation. And Einstein looked at his work and he went, my God, you're right. And so they produced a theory called the Einstein Gödel, G-O-D-E-L, metric. And this was for a rotating universe. The amazing thing about the Einstein-Gödel metric is that if you solve the two remaining variables that are required in the equation, which are background radiation and the spin of the cosmic dust, then time travel is axiomatic. And so
That's right. And I want to talk a little bit about that, but we do have a caller on the line.
Oh, good, 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 good.
Welcome to X-Squared Radio.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Your first.
How
are you?
Jayla from Tennessee.
This
is off topic somewhat, but with you being geologist, physicist, and all that, Dr. Brooks Agnew, I would like for you to make comment on, in my opinion, this insanity that the Army Corps of Engineers is thinking about blowing up the New Madrid Fault.
Well, I wasn't aware of that, but I wouldn't put it past them.
Oh, yeah, they're going to do it. If the flood level rises to 61 feet in the next 24 hours, they are going to blow it, which will flood 134,000 acres of farmland to save one little town called Cairo, Illinois, but pronounced Cairo there. Population 2,800.
Well, I did hear that they were going to blow a levee to allow allow the farmland to flood and relieve the pressure of the river. But why would you think that's actually blowing the New Madrid Fault?
Because it sets right on the New Madrid. Now, here's another interesting little tidbit. Seems that the Army Corps of Engineers and the USGS can't get their story straight. The Army Corps of Engineers is saying these sand boils that are popping up all over the place around that localized area are caused due to the pressure of the water and liquefaction of the soil around there, which, you know, happened during the Great New Madrid earthquake. But the USGS says that's due to earthquake activity and the liquefaction of the soil pre-earthquake timing. And they say that this problem was very prevalent in Japan right before the big quake back on March 11th. So there seems to be conflicting stories there between government entities.
Yeah, well, that's not too surprising. The USGS has a different set of scientists than the Army Corps of Engineers, which are mostly concerned with the management of water and the storage of water for power and water management. But liquefaction, I'm from Southern California originally, and that's one of the problems that we have, is that structures that have been around since the 40s or 50s were once thought to be a nice solid clay ground, but when low frequency vibration, high amplitude is poured into the soil, all of that goes liquid. It turns into kind of a dry mud and it moves. And that's what these sand boils are that are popping up all over the place. And we have been getting these little, not microquakes, but somewhere around 3 or less on the Richter scale in that area. And this is theorized to be preparatory quakes for a big one. And
not to mention all the dead birds and fish since January 1 there, too.
People need to realize that
up the New Madrid.
But the New Madrid Fault is not a Pacific Rim fault. This is a fault that goes right down the middle of the continental plate that is the United States. It goes from the Canadian border all the way to the Gulf of Mexico, right down the middle of the nation. The last time we had a very big quake on this was in the early 1800s, before 1830. And it was so violent.
1811, 12, right.
Yes. It was so violent that the Mississippi River ran backwards and formed Real Foot Lake. If that
Are you aware
today,
that the Mississippi has been running backwards again now in the last few days because of the swollen rivers and the Mississippi can't take on the water as fast as it's running from the tributaries into it, and so the water's actually flowing back into the tributaries?
I wasn't aware of that, but I flew over Memphis the other day and you could see water as far as the horizon.
Oh, yes. And they've had tornado warnings going off all day long over there. I've been watching their local station there on the internet. And they're very concerned about the flooding. And they're already at this third time all high for flood levels right now, and they're predicting, because they've already had another 4 inches of rain, I believe they said today. And the way the weather patterns are holding, even for us here in the Nashville area, we're beginning to get nervous about flooding also. We had it last week, and of course, you know, the ground is so saturated, there's nowhere for
the
water to go now.
One of the things I mentioned in the opening news clip, during the month of April, normally we have about 180 tornadoes. This April, we've had over 800 tornadoes.
Yes.
And May is considered often historically to be a worse month in April.
Correct.
For tornadoes.
Correct.
Just,
yeah. We dodged the bullet here last Wednesday. But, boy, I feel so sorry for the people in Alabama.
Harp-like weapon. And we're looking for some evidence that may be happening. We haven't seen it so far, but it does seem very strange.
Do you think that this would have anything to do with the oscillation of, you know, since the big oil spill out there in the Gulf that shut down the fresh waters and the salt water salinity mixture that oscillates our seasons that has now, in some scientific circles, that has shut down? Do you think this is causing quote-unquotations around there, these inland hurricanes now?
Ooh, I don't know. What do you think, Joe?
Actually, I don't think so. But, you know, there again, this isn't something that I particularly studied, and that's the difficult part about taking callers is that, you know, you get outside of what your particular area of expertise is, and I really don't
it's outside
like
of my area of expertise as well.
So, but it is starting to sound like an Edgar Cayce prophecy, and that's for sure. And he mentioned quite frequently on Coast to Coast, which is where I heard Brooks. And point that I would like to address again is that all of this mad science really started happening during the Manhattan Project during World War II,
mm-hmm.
when we had over 200,000 employees in the federal government that were all part of secret science. And I'm convinced that they've turned into mad scientists, and they're not above geoengineering. And genetically modified organisms are a perfect example of absolute stupidity gone wild. So,
I would have to agree with you 100%.
And there's a possibility that we have capabilities with HAARP. Everybody's mentioned it. I haven't investigated enough to convince myself that I'm positive on it. But I'm objective enough to say that we may have a lot of capabilities that are beyond what I would even think. And the problem is we're not being governed by people that are principled. And so the chance that they would be misused is highly possible. So it could be.
Well, they're sociological psychopaths. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're psychopaths on every level.
I did my postgraduate work at Oak Ridge. And, Oak Ridge.
Hello?
Well, Graham's on the road. I mean, Brooks is on the road, so occasionally he runs into a cell tower.
Well, he'll lose his signal. Yeah. You know, there was a YouTube video today that I saw that they actually picked up signatures of a HAARP display right over the top of that volcano that just erupted 2 days ago in Japan. And right before the big tornado outbreak last Wednesday, they were picking up HAARP signatures throughout this area on like the Tuesday before. So that would certainly make as the meteorologist kept saying, make the atmosphere juicy. You've got hot and cold air. You had a jet stream that had dipped down lower than they'd ever seen it, and it was at 170 miles an hour. And I think that this contributed a lot to these massive supercells. Do you know that one of those tornadoes stayed on the ground? It hit Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and it stayed on the ground for, I think, 170 over 200 miles all the way up to Ringgold that killed so many people there in Georgia, right below Chattanooga. That's never happened before. Those are what they call long track supercell tornado storms. They'd never seen it before. I mean, you know, you tune into the different weather advisories through the different TV stations of different states, and all the meteorologists were just absolutely going bonkers and scratching their heads going, this is biblical proportion. This is epic. We've never seen anything like this. We don't know how this could be happening. Those were common phrases being used.
Well, and then there was the other statement that it's the worst.
Is this nature, or did nature get some help?
Are we got Brooks back online?
Yes, yes, I'm here. When I was making a comment about HAARP, you know, we're not the only ones with HAARP technology.
Nope.
And I have demonstrated both on History Channel and on True TV how HAARP can be used to manipulate water vapor molecules in the atmosphere. The idea that we might be targeted by a HAARP weapon, I don't mean our own HAARP weapon. When I was doing my postgraduate work at Oak Ridge, I rubbed shoulders with a lot of people who were around during the Manhattan Project. One of the guys that I get my sodium iodide crystals from to make my gamma spectrometers was a Marine in charge of guarding the Manhattan Project people and actually monitoring them to make sure that they didn't share any secrets outside their particular small scientific community. The stories that this individual told me were just amazing. The idea that there were discussions going on that these guys did not know that if they push the button to start a hydrogen fusion reaction for a fusion bomb called the hydrogen bomb, they did not know whether or not they would actually light the atmosphere of the Earth on fire. Now, when they proved that the system worked, of course, the report was made within the hour to Truman. Truman gave the order to build the bomb and get it expedited to the battlefield as quickly as possible. That's how insane the leadership was at that time. That style of leadership in the military community, especially the upper ranks, still exists today.
And they're still in control today. That's the frightening part.
Well, isn't there something, I heard something a while back about the Tesla technology that Tesla was working on, that actually one of the reasons, and this is internet rumor, but one of the reasons that he quit is because he had actually tapped into some power source through the atmosphere that could crack the Earth in two. Did you hear anything about that, Bruce?
Well, the idea that the Earth would shatter, that you could find the resonant frequency of the Earth, that you could add enough energy to the Earth to cause that to happen, is a little bit beyond belief, because you got gravity to overcome and all of that, and you're only going to affect the crust anyway, which is a small portion of the mass of the Earth. But the idea that the Earth is changing in the speed of its rotation, that the North Magnetic Pole is now moving at a rate of 25 miles per year toward Russia, that these forces are out there and they're unstable and they're moving in the way that they're moving, indicates that there is some instability. There is a tipping point to this planet in which it could become unstable in a way that would not necessarily annihilate life, but it might make life as we know it a little bit different.
Yeah.
Hence the biblical proportions. Add to that the fact that the entire solar system is now in a neck of the woods, in which it's being exposed to a new set of frequencies, or should I say frequencies we have not been exposed to for 26,500 years or thereabouts, and a whole new set of resonant frequencies and sympathetic resonations are becoming apparent in the symptoms of what we see in our planet. It just so happens that we're alive at the time and we have instruments sensitive enough to be able to pick up these variations, and we really don't know what to make of them.
Yeah, we definitely picked a great time to be here this time around, didn't we?
Well, we got a front row seat to whatever's happening, and at least we got enough people aware that we can come up with possible theories. One of the other guests that they have on Coast to Coast is a guy named Graham Hancock. Have you read any of his work?
Uh-huh.
He's written a book called Underworld.
Sure, yeah. I'm familiar with Graham. He's a great mind, and he certainly has a presence on the History Channel and Science Channel, and we think a lot of him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's brilliant. Well, he is.
Well, obviously.
Well, you know, just go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. Obviously, human beings have been in about the same biological condition for about 200,000 years at least. And so we've had the capability of creating the same levels of technology and the same levels of understanding at various times in the past, particularly during the interglacial period. So we would have had several interglacials that could have been like that. There's so many common human myths, origin myths and flood myths and, you know, disaster myths that are cross-cultural, that it kind of indicates that we have been through these kind of events before, and it's highly possible that we're entering them from a natural standpoint, or it could be man-made or man-enhanced at this point. But definitely we're facing a time of increased awareness of what all the different vulnerabilities are. Whether we're able to do anything about them or not is another
fact. The
idea
that there is some history, that left in the ancient record is at least some history that this has occurred before. Even though the actual occurrence isn't there, the remembrance of the occurrence is there. And what's really remarkable is cast in the record of the Maya and the Babylonians and even the Sumerians is this warning about this time around 2012, which hopefully we're not too far off in our calendar, and we have some sense of where the steering wheel is in this front row seat we have that you're talking about. But the question is, why did these ancient civilizations leave that message for a civilization that would live 1,500 years in the future? We wouldn't leave a message for our own grandkids, let alone a society that lived 1,500 years in the future. And yet they did, and they left it in such a way that it would withstand volcanoes and tempests and hurricanes over the centuries until we would be scratching our heads today going, I wonder what they were thinking of when they built that. Maybe that's the kind of awakening that we're going through right now. That's why minds like Graham and you and me and others are out there talking about it, and why there are hundreds of thousands of people listening tonight, and there will be millions during the week listening again. And waking up to the idea that we have been through this before.
Absolutely. And perhaps maybe some of all of those ancient times, just like the Colburn Bible, written by Egyptians, perhaps it was to remind us of where we've been and the mistakes that maybe as a past civilization we made to help us to try to remember not to do this again, to get it right this time.
Interesting thought. By the way, I would maintain that it wasn't the Egyptians that left that message. It was the race before the Egyptians got there. And that's why my latest book's called Remembering the Future, because that's exactly what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. I think the Egyptians are the ancient Atlanteans. I think that's where they left and made it to that next shore. What do you say?
That's an interesting theory. Others think that the Irish and the Scots are the ancient Atlanteans, and that the Egyptians, or those that are now the descendants of, are actually the Lemurians from the Pacific area.
Hmm. And there's also speculation that the 2,000-foot-deep ruins off the coast of Cuba and also ruins in the Bahamas could have been the Atlanteans. So, you know, hopefully, we'll be finding out a whole bunch of things here in the near future about humans' past and our future.
And well, we're going to have to shed a lot of dogma before that occurs.
Boy, I am
yes,
so ready.
It's really hard to get the dogmatic ideas and attitudes of our scientific community as a whole to admit they were wrong. And throw out the old books, save some of it maybe, but start looking in a new direction and say, hey, you know, we got to rethink this whole thing again. I can tell
I like
you one
that.
Thing. There's an article that just came out today that says the scientific community is terrified of a discovery they've made now that strange emissions from the sun are mutating matter here on Earth, that everything is mutating now. Well, I think that the Mayans and the Incas and pretty much all your indigenous have talked about this time where the galactic center would be bringing in new energies which transmutes matter. Comments?
Like well, there is a metamorphosis going on.
I like that phrase from the 60s. I'm sorry if my karma ran over your dogma.
That's pretty good. I like that.
I'll listen to you guys off air.
Hey, thanks.
All right. Thank you so much for the call.
All right.
Remember, Earth Explorers, that the phone lines are open, so you can call in with questions, thoughts, ideas. This is Stories from the Road tonight with X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. My guest is Joe Olson, author of many, many articles that have not only stimulated but put in question many popular ideas out there by the scientific community. And I appreciate the intelligence, the thoughtfulness, and the factual research that's done in putting these articles together and exposing the frilly underwear of the staunch and, shall I say, religiosity of our scientific community. So we will continue. Joe, your thoughts?
Actually, there have been a few times during this whole process where I got just so completely bored with the people that we were dealing with that I wrote articles that are actually satire. One of them is called the Modern Phrenology Society Newsletter. And phrenology was that late 19th century art where they would measure your skull with a set of calipers, and then based on the shape of your skull, they would tell you things about your personality traits. And
yeah, they actually measured the bumps on your skull and predict things about your personality.
It was really involved. It was, that along with alchemy are the two most glaring errors in science, and I think that climatology is going to fall into that category here in the very near future, and it certainly deserves to. But also, there's a whole bunch of other ranges of science that are going to be put to a new empirical test. I wrote an article called Nullius in Verba, which is Latin, and it happens to be the motto of the Royal Society of London. And it literally translates to take no man's word for it. But my article was posted at Canada Free Press, and I outranked the Royal Society for over a year. And they had their motto since 1661, and I used their motto and outranked them as Google ratings for over a year. It was absolutely hilarious. But, we've got to get back to empirical base. The wonderful thing about our universe is that it's based on truth. Everything we see is truth. So, when you study true science and you study true cause and effect, you're learning truth. And it's reinforced truth, and it may vary somewhat based on circumstances, but it's not mutable like the truth that they want to force upon us. And that's the blessing that we've got, is that somewhere there, you may or may not want to subscribe to it. A lot of people don't, but if there's not a supreme being, there's certainly beings that are more intelligent than us. And there's certainly something that created a vast, complex universe that's extremely well-ordered. And you're talking about all these mutations. One thing that Darwin didn't have access to would have been genetic codes that could have explained to him that there is no mutation that humans can cause that increases species. The mutations that we cause always cause a degradation in the species. We can't, for instance, create extra chromosomes and make a larger chromosome gene pool. We can only affect within that gene pool. And there's certain things that do happen on, it appears to be periodic basis, where the universe, where the world that we live in, certainly undergoes enormous changes in a real short period of time that cause a whole range of genetic improvements, which are pretty much unexplained.
Well, that's true. You have the idea of irreducible complexity, where whole pieces of well-organized code are dropped into things as simple as single-celled animals and plants, and then you also have complex splicing that is done in complex organisms like, say, the cheetah or the ape, or we can even look at humans, where we expected when we were examining the human genome to find a hugely complex genome, and that's not what we found at all. What we found was a gene pair number that was lower than what we expected, so low, in fact, that in order to explain the number of proteins that we make as human physiologies, we had to come to the realization that genes make more than one protein. In fact, they have a choice of all kinds of proteins that they can make. And where we really began to notice this is when we studied the genome of identical twins over a period of time. Although they were genetically identical at birth, later in life, in their teens, in their 20s, in their 30s, their 40s, in their 50s, their genetic code became different because the environment, even though they were eating the same food, wearing the same clothes, living in the same neighborhood, their genetic code was changing because the environment included the consciousness of the being inside the body. And that what was changing the code. Now, science, and I've already talked about religiosity of science, regularly throws out data because it doesn't fit the paradigm theory, and thus maybe soiling the robes of the PhD that happens to be standing there talking about it, and upon which they have based their illustrious career and intimidated many a fine-thinking student with it. The modern thinker, and I'm going to use that term instead of scientist, realizes that the data, the empirical knowledge that Joe's just talking about, points to a different theory, a different reality, that there is an organizing energy. There are organizing laws in the universe that allow irreducible complexity, whole pieces of knowledge, whole pieces of organized thought and formula to drop into segments of our creation and thus change it, morph it. It goes through metamorphosis. It goes through evolution, not by cross species modification, but through growth and through organizing forces that seem to be present in the universe. Is this along your thought process?
Oh, definitely. There's a universal conscious which our education process will force out of your mind, but if you actually let yourself hear it, there's voices in your head that are far better than anything you're going to hear anywhere else. you have an internal compass that's pointing towards truth, and all you have to do is just block out some of the interference that you're getting from the reality, and you can start seeing a far greater truth. And that's what we're both talking to, and we're the new wave of thought, because there's a whole bunch of people that are the same way, that we're saying that it is possible to think of a far greater universe and produce a far greater reality for us in a very short period of time once we can overcome this negativity that's been imposed upon us by the power elites that control the current reality.
Yeah, now you might say it to yourself, especially if you're not a scientist, you're not an engineer, you don't have access to these advanced tools. What can I do about it? How can I get involved in that? What effect could I possibly have on the course of the universe? Well, that is probably the most important question of existence as a conscious being on the earth. Your thoughts and your intention with those thoughts is part of the creative process. Your ability to put an image, a concept, a vision out there in the future is as much a part of the creative process as if God himself came down to this planet and pointed his finger and made it happen.
you see very little that you don't want to see. So if you want to see an alternative reality and you want to make it happen, it's there for the taking. You know, for a long time I was intimidated by the word scientist, and I kept going, well, you know, I really can't take part in this debate because I'm not a scientist, I'm an engineer. And then at some point it dawned on me, wait a minute, who are these white lab-coated scientists that I'm sitting here bowing to? I've had as much physics as a physics major, as much chemistry as a chemistry major, as much math as a math major. What a scientist is an engineer who didn't want to go to school for an extra year. I'm not going to sit here and be browbeat by you people when I know you're lying to me. And that's the empowerment. It's the point when you say, I don't have to listen to garbage. There is real truth available, and I'm capable of understanding it, and I'm capable of seeing an alternative explanation for reality that makes far greater sense and is far more compassionate and far more connected to the universal conscience. And that's what we're working
on. I couldn't agree more. And I would maintain that the rest of you out there don't need to be intimidated, even if you haven't had the math that we have had, even if you haven't been browbeat by many a PhD in a chemistry class or a physics class. You have an innate ability which is greater than any other form of life on the planet to envision the birth of planets and the movement of quanta in your own mind, in your own thought process. That ability to envision can be as much a part of the creative process as a quote-unquote educated person might have.
What people don't seem to realize is we're like Dorothy in Oz, and we're standing there with our little ruby slippers, and we don't realize that all we got to do is clack them together. Sitting on your desk right now is a PC that is bigger than any library in the world. And not only that, it has the world's greatest librarian. When I mentioned earlier the article that I read about the interview with Hubble from Time magazine from 1936, I could have spent a year in the New York Library and never stumbled across that particular newspaper interview. I put it into a search engine, and boom, it pops up, and it's like readily apparent. You have the capability of discovering more than you can even possibly imagine. What you got to do is get disconnected from American Idol and get disconnected with Dancing from the Stars and start doing something with your brain and your life and your friends, and you need to be communicating and sharing this stuff and discovering on a whole different level, and it's right there waiting for you to happen. You need to click your heels a few times. That's all we're saying.
Yeah, exactly. And I want to add something to that, and that is that, you know, institutional, that is to say affiliated educational institutions around the world, whether they're colleges, universities, city colleges, high schools, or private schools, have no monopoly any longer on knowledge. And if you're a smart person and you can learn yourself at your own rate, not only can you exceed what can be taught to you from a teacher in a classroom, but you will probably have more current knowledge, because by the time that teacher or that professor gets out of school, goes through their training, goes through their associate professorship, their professorship, and gets that classroom of young, nubile minds, their knowledge is already outdated. And the knowledge that you are grasping on the internet, and I would caution you to use wisdom when you're doing this research, is greater, more current, more viable, and probably more transitory, that is to say, cross-associative, multidisciplinary, than the knowledge you're getting in that same classroom.
The phrase I love about people with PhDs is that they keep learning more and more about less and less until finally they know everything about nothing.
Well, that's why I call my PhD a pulse hole digger. I've got one. It keeps my muscles strong. I can dig a lot of holes.
And the way they've maintained their power is by controlling the peer review groups. And that's what the internet has also done, and that's what the Slaying the Sky Dragon authors have proven, is that we're able to collect outside of the selected peer review committees, and we're able to get a message of a broad science impact across to a wide audience without being restrained by having happened to conform to the dogma. Our book is currently in print in England, United States, Canada, and Australia. Next month it will be issued in Swedish, Portuguese, Spanish, and German. So we'll be in five languages on four continents. When I posted my very first article, One Pleasant Day in Runnymede, which Runnymede happens to be the little field outside of Windsor Castle where they forced King John to sign the Magna Carta in 1215. And I wrote this article called One Pleasant Day in Runnymede, and I sent it off to a bunch of different online websites, and this happened to be the very first one I had published at Canada Free Press. I was so excited, I went over to a friend's house, and he said, well, you want to see how many other places have your article posted? I went, yeah, great. He goes, well, look, if you put it in the search engine, the exact title of your article in quotation marks, it'll show you all the other links. Well, this article was posted like 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. By 6 p.m., which was 3 hours later, it had 100 cross links, and it was already translated into Thai, Korean, Japanese, French, and Belgian. So I was in six languages in 3 hours. Within another 24 hours, I was in Hebrew, Russian, Finnish, Swedish, you know, I mean, on and on and on. And that's the power that we have with the internet. Not only can I write something in and put it up where a million people can read it, I can write something and put it in 12 languages that I don't even speak and have it done almost instantaneously. And that's
where the power is. So you have the gift of tongues.
Oh, it's an unbelievable, force multiplier. And it's what we're gonna need to be able to create the new Eden on Earth, which I'm certainly, sure that human beings are capable of once we throw off this yoke. And that's what I'm working towards.
It's slowly, it is slowly peeling off. There's a stratification occurring in the educational community today. I have been an academic in the sense that I've taught college level algebra and statistics and physics, but, you know, I like to build stuff. So I'm out here in the real world building things that, people can use and creating jobs and saving jobs and trying to move technology towards something that makes a lot more energy sense with what we do with our planet, at least from my point of view. However, I know enough about the academic community to see that there is a stratification occurring within it. Universities are having to raise their tuitions. They're having to ask for more money from states, not because the actual cost of the education is going up, but because the enrollment is going down. And it's not because people are not going to college because they're dumb. It's because they're not going to college because they don't see a need. Many, many corporations out there are now dropping the requirement for a bachelor's degree from their engineers' job descriptions because they're not getting smart people from the colleges. They're getting smart people from maintenance people who have been turning wrenches their whole life but have educated themselves in advanced engineering, fluid dynamics, heat transfer, force mechanics, metallurgy on the net. They have taught themselves from the same textbooks that the universities are using, but they've done it in such a way that they have real-world empathetic knowledge to go with the book knowledge, and they're a much more valuable engineer to the corporations.
I don't argue with that at all. We've gotten to the point where the colleges are so theoretical and they're so removed from the empirical, like we mentioned before, that the college education is becoming less and less valuable. So
it's true. You know, Europe has what appears to be a very effective educational process because they use the system of apprenticeship. We don't have apprenticeship so much in this country. We have co-ops, But we don't really put a whole lot of emphasis on that. We'd rather see somebody come out of college with a 4.0 and maybe a master's degree in heat transfer or economics or an MBA or something like that. But when we actually put them in the job, in the plant, they're like a bull in a china shop. They don't have the skill to be able to use something as simple as a lathe or as a CNC. They don't really understand how things go together and how things are built and how they come apart. For instance, in the electric vehicle industry, we actually have companies out there producing vehicles with motors that turn at the rate of 15 to 20,000 RPM. Well, that sounds wonderful. On the bench, I'm sure they do. But when you put those things on a cobblestone road or over railroad tracks or vary the temperature 100, 120 degrees from one day to the next, when something comes apart at 15,000 RPM, it does so catastrophically because they don't have the real world experience of actually building things and watching it work in real life. So, and this is what we're seeing in industry. What we're seeing in industry is a disconnect between what is theory and what is practical knowledge. And that apprenticeship idea, which is lost in the American educational system, is now coming alive because you have people that have been out there working for 10 years since they got out of high school, and they're smart. They can't afford to go to college. They can't afford to take 5 years out of their life and live like a pauper in a apartment off food stamps, raising three children, and go to school to get that sheepskin we call a diploma.
Or to go into debt to the tune of $100,000 in student loans that will burden you for the rest of your life, which is another false means of improvement. But
sure.
I read a piece by an economist probably about 2 weeks ago, which kind of echoes this on a little bit different scale. He said that they've been continuing to tell us that we could have a creative economy instead of a productive economy. Instead of manufacturing things, all we had to do was create things. Well, first of all, if you create something, it can be duplicated millions of times, and so the single creation process doesn't have near the productive capability. But the point that this economist made is that at the point when you quit manufacturing things, you quit getting the need for innovation. You quit having the capability for innovation. If you're working in a factory every day and you see a better way of manufacturing a part, you can improve it. If you're working in a office cubicle and you never see a machine part, then there's no way you're going to ever provide an improvement for one. And that's what we've got to do. We've got to reestablish an industrial base in our nation. And we've had this systematically stolen from us, just like we mentioned earlier, by our capital going overseas and creating Chinese plants and Chinese industry and creating a Chinese economy so that they could steal our copyrights and our intellectual property to come back and destroy our industrial base so that the people at the top of the pyramid here in America can buy the country for 10 cents on the dollar. And I'm sorry.
Well,
that's
exactly right. I had this meeting with Ambassador of Trade Ron Kirk last year. I sat down face to face with him and a congressman and 9 other companies, 25 businessmen, 9 other companies in the meeting. And I told him that very thing. We are losing our intellectual property, our copyrights, our patents, to these countries who don't honor our intellectual property rights. When we share enough of our idea to get something built that they can then make and supply to us, we are then facing our own product at a trade show built by the very same suppliers that we gave the idea to. What are you going to do about it? And I'm telling you, the International Trade Administration has no teeth. No one is afraid of them.
And they're not going to do anything to stem the flow. This is a conscious effort. They are in running our nation. And if you read my article, that one, I'll take some e pluribus, but hold the unum, perfect example was Westinghouse. Here was a guy who was like 19 years old, invented his first invention, which was a steam turbine. There wasn't a need for a steam turbine at the time, but then by the time he was 22 years old, he witnessed a huge train wreck because at that time all they had was reversing the steam flow in the reciprocal steam engine of the locomotive to brake them. And you get a large train going, it took forever to stop one, and so he developed the air brake system and got a patent on it. Well, he was making a tremendous amount of money selling them because, you know, it greatly improved the safety and the performance of rail systems. But the rail systems were owned by the Carnegies and the Mellons and the Rockefellers and the, you know, the East Coast monopolists. And so they wanted to steal his production capabilities. So they ordered a set of, an order 20,000 air brakes to be, you know, delivered on a certain date. And so he gets a commitment from one of the people who's the steel supplier. And he gets another commitment from somebody who's the coal supplier. He gets another commitment from somebody who's the railroad company who's going to ship all this stuff. And then he gets a bank loan to be able to fulfill this order for air brakes. And then suddenly they don't provide him with the steel, and somebody else won't ship it, and then somebody else won't provide him with the coal to make his foundries work. And next thing you know, he's in default, and so they come in and say, well, you know, you can give us your patent, and we'll set your company back up. That's the same trick they played on Edison. Same trick they played on Westinghouse when he built the first three-phase power system at Niagara Falls using Tesla technology. They systematically go in and bankrupt people that have good ideas so that they can control all of the most productive ideas on the planet. And now they're systematically controlling and bankrupting every individual in the nation that comes up with creative ideas.
Well, that's what's happened to the electric vehicle industry. You'll remember back in when Obama was elected that he picked up the electric vehicle football and said the same thing that eight presidents had said before him. We're addicted to foreign oil. We need electric power. We need to empower small business. Job creation happens at the small business level. And I'm going to instruct the Department of Energy to pour billions of dollars into small business so that we can bring this technology to you today. Rah, rah, rah. Applause. Flashing lights. And now the confetti comes down. And then we, that is to say companies like mine, go to the Department of Energy and apply for these wonderful programs that Obama has said that we qualify for and that he can't wait to give us money to. And lo and behold, 8 months later, every dime of that money is given to the global corporations. Nothing goes to small business. I had this discussion just this last week in Washington. I was there. And they said, well, this company and that company, I won't mention any names, they got money from the DOE. Actually, I said, that's not true. They got loan guarantees, which means they had to go out to a bank, they had to put up collateral, they had to put up down payments and fees, and they got a loan, and then the government came in and underwrote a portion of that loan. That's what motivated the bank to actually give the loan. But that company, that electric car company, will be bankrupt and gone before the government ever gives their money to that bank to indemnify that bank, because they only underwrite a portion of that loan. The truth is that the 20 or so electric car companies that did come up with the innovative technology, the game-changing, disruptive technology that's trying to get on the American highway today, none of them got any money, and most of them are bankrupt today. Tesla, the household name in electric vehicles, their upper management is working for $1 a year. Each one of them had to put in $10 million or more of their own money, and to date, they have received $0 in grants. And it is common knowledge in that plant in California that Toyota is getting ready to sell the building or the land that the building's on to a local football franchise. That plant is going to go away. And all of the technology that you see in Tesla's plant is going to be owned by Toyota and General Motors.
Welcome to the monopolist game. And actually, it's a blessing if you can avoid their capital stream, because they will do the same pump and dump on you that they did on Edison, Westinghouse, and Tesla. They will, give you enough funding and then deprive you of a market long enough to be able to steal whatever intellectual property you do have or do develop. So
the plan is to stay away from the patent office, stay out of debt, and don't go public. And this doesn't give those global corporations the tools that they need to take you down.
Well, the automobile design that I had, originally I came up with it as part of a presentation to the junior class at St. John Divine's High School. It's an elite finishing school here in Houston, on the corner of River Oaks Boulevard and Westheimer, and only the most upper crust kids go there. And they had seen me on a local TV news broadcast talking about some civic issues in town, a functional rail system, and a few other items, which I have a video posted at my Faux Science Slayer site, and invited me to be a speaker at their Futures Day. And knowing high school kids, and particularly sophisticated high school kids, I said, well, it's going to bore them to death to talk about civics work projects. So I'll do the first 20 minutes talking about the most inspirational speaker I ever heard in my life, and that was Bucky Fuller. And I had heard Bucky as an engineering student back in the early 70s. And here's a guy who had the shape of an egg, had a Yul Brynner haircut, glasses as thick as Coke bottle bottoms, got up 80 years old in front of 5,000 students at the University of Houston Cullen Auditorium, and spoke for 2 hours, and all he did was stop once to take a sip of water out of a glass, and he said, I forgot what I was talking about. He goes, never mind, and he took off talking again. And here was a guy that crossed every universal boundary. He talked on the microscopic to the cosmic level. And I was sitting with fellow engineering students who were all very sophisticated scientists, and we were all just staring at each other and blinking, going, this guy has not made a single technical error in 2 hours of presentation, and he never looked at a single index card. And so I talked to the junior class about that, and then I ended up talking to him about this car design. And my car design, 1,500 pounds, had a 80 horsepower at that time, which I'm sure we'd be capable of doing 100 horsepower now, gas engine in the rear, and 20 horsepower of electric motors and a few lead acid batteries in the front, and that was it, 1,500 pounds. It was built like a ping pong ball. You could smack into it with a cement truck, and four people would walk away unhurt. It would cost half the price of any current car. And it had a better power-to-weight ratio than a V8 Mustang. I had a whole room full of high school kids jumping up and down going, oh, my God, this is great, this is great, this is great. Well, amazingly enough, a month later, I was in a private meeting with my U.S. Representative, Bill Archer, District 7 U.S. Congress, was chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, served in Congress for 30 years, was on the Ways and Means Committee almost all that time, and whenever Republicans were in power, he was chairman. I met with him, and I explained my car idea to him, and he goes, well, that's pretty interesting. He goes, what's the downsides? I said, well, the downsides are that if we build this car, it's going to take a fourth the amount of labor and half the amount of material and going to sell for half the price, so we're going to lose half the jobs in Washington, D.C., because nobody could ever be killed in this car. It's going to reduce insurance rates by 50%. Because we're going to be using 200 miles per gallon instead of 20, I said it's going to decimate the petroleum industry. And he said, well, what if we don't build? But I said, we must build this car, and if we do, we'll be a net energy export. He says, well, what if we don't build this car? This is in March 2nd, 1990. I looked Bill Archer in the eye and I said, if America doesn't build this car in 20 years, General Motors will be bankrupt and half the U.S. Treasury will be overseas. And he started laughing. And I went, well,
yeah,
you can believe me if you want, but here we are 20 years later, General Motors was exactly bankrupt and half of the U.S. Treasury was overseas. And you don't have to be a prophet or a visionary to see the reality. All you have to do is just be plugged into it. It's there. And we need to create a new reality. We need to get a new set of leaders, and we need to have a new definition of science. And we can create a whole different world. So
yes, we can. Yes, we can. And it is within our power to do. And it is within our power to do in on the short term. This does not take 10 years. We can do this in 1 year or 2 years at the outside. That's how quick it can occur. Now,
well,
I would like to add to this that NAPQP meeting, this is the advanced product quality planning meeting that we go through in the quality system of the major car makers, set up by the automotive industry action group, the AIAG, and we were talking about what's called the T265 program, which is, you know, it as the CTS Cadillac program. They decided to put this 385 horsepower V6 and make it a hot rod instead of a high mileage vehicle. And I stood up in the meeting after they made the power plant decision and I said, you all are going to go broke. You all are running commercials with tire smoking, sideways drifting, 400 horsepower cars that break every traffic law ever written by the time they get out of second gear, and that's not what the American public is looking for. I didn't know how right I was. GM did go broke. And I watched TV this morning before I left the shop in Florida, and they're still running the tire smoking, sideways drifting cars. Still don't get it.
And with their $7,000 tax credit you get for buying their silly Chevy Volt, and with orders from several hundred to the U.S. government, they sold 280 in the month of February. The first month they were on market, they sold nationwide a pittance, you know, four vehicles per state. Big deal. You know, this is what's going to save your corporation. We're selling four of these in every state. Wow. And half of those
yeah.
are government sales, and that's with a $7,000 prop-up. How long can we continue fronting that particular bill? Well, I'm
well, now, there are some details here that people need to realize. That $7,500 tax rebate, don't get it all when you buy a Volt, because a Volt is a hybrid. Okay, it doesn't actually get the mileage specs that get that full 7,500. Second thing is that 7,500 is income based. It's a tax rebate. It depends on your income whether you get the 7,500 or not. The third thing is it only applies to the first 100,000 vehicles. After that, it goes away.
Well, you were saying something earlier about how long it's going to take for this transition to happen. And I'm heartened by a previous transition that happened without the monopolist control and without their timetable. And that was the fall of the Berlin Wall. All of the garbage they tell you about Ronald Reagan's defense spending brought the Soviet Union to their knees is absolute baloney. Communism never worked. It only works at the point of a gun. And they were there were previous revolutions inside the behind the Iron Curtain. There was one in Hungary in 1956. There was one in Czechoslovakia in 1968. And in both of those revolutions, the state owned the printing presses. They owned the broadcast media. They owned the film processing labs. And the most that you could do would have been to write something with a typewriter and have six carbon copies, and they had every typewriter in the country registered. People had no ability to communicate. The same thing happened in Czechoslovakia when they invaded in 68. What was different was that in the 90s, the U.S. and Western technologies were improving so fast that there was no hope that the Soviet Union would be able to even maintain equity with us at all. They couldn't steal our ideas fast enough, and they couldn't incorporate them without having communication. And therein lies the key. They said, well, we'll allow you to have pro printers, and you can have fax machines, and you can have Xerox machines. And once you turn loose of control of communication and information, then the people have freedom. And at some point, the people in Poland realized that the Russians still had 40,000 tanks, but if they came into Poland, Poland had Sony Betacams, and they had satellite uplinks, and we had fax machines, and fine, if you want to come in and crush us, we'll let the world see it. And Russia blinked. And when Russia blinked, East Germany looked over the border and went, hey, we've got fax machines and cell phones and satellite uplinks and Betacams. We want some of that freedom stuff too. And it swept all the way across the globe, and it got all the way to Tiananmen Square. And guess who was president in 1989 when it got to Tiananmen Square? George Bush, former director of the CIA, former ambassador to China, had already greased the wheels over there with the Chinese communists and said, look, we'll prop up your phony baloney slave state and let you crush this democracy movement and get away with it, but here's what you're going to do. And that's when they cut the deal with the Chinese, who at that point were still living in the Mao Iron Rice Bowl stage. They couldn't put two weapons together if they had to. And we have given them in the last 20 years the capability to completely destroy us. And we've done it willingly, and it's been done from the top with the express purpose of destroying our freedom so that they can create a worldwide slave state, just like they've created the model for in China today. But they've got the same problem there. The people in China do have access now to various other forms of information, and they do have access to various products, and they are being exposed to the benefits of free thought and free enterprise to the extent that they think they've got it, and they will start demanding more things of their government. So what I see happening,
and they already are. They already are. You know, when you look at 2.6 million or 2.6 billion Chinese, when you drive across their country, and I've done it, you pass mile after mile after mile of farmland, and you see farms, millions of acres of farms, and not a single tractor. It is all farmed by hand. Farm animals, not horse-driven plows, by hand. That slave state is eating their lunch.
And they're going to be faced with the real short-term possibility of you. They got to start exterminating large masses of people worldwide in order to maintain their power base, or they've just got to go, well, it looks like Freedom won and the monopoly is over. And I'm pulling for the Freedom won aspect. I think we can beat these people, and I think we've got more than enough power, more than enough intelligence, and we've got the goodwill of the universal conscience on our side. So I'm very optimistic that not only will we see a more rapid turnaround, but we will see one very dramatically in a time frame that's unpredicted. And just like
I couldn't agree more. I want to remind the listeners, we have about 45 minutes or about 40 minutes left in the program. The phone lines are open. Now, the network is absolutely packed with listeners right now. I don't know how many people are listening out there, but we are right about at the peak of the network. So those of you that know the BBS Radio Network, you know that it is the largest and most listened to internet radio networks in the world. And right now there are lots and lots of listeners out there. So be advised, you can call in. The numbers are posted at bbsradio.com, channel 2, and they are also posted at xsquaredradio.com. So if you're listening on a radio broadcast, rebroadcast of this internet source, go to those two websites. You can find the phone numbers on there, and you are free to call in for the next 40 minutes. My guest is Joe Olson.
Yes.
Line 3 is the only line that's open. So if you go to the website, look up line 3, call that in, and you can get on the program. My guest is Joe Olson. I'm Brooks Agnew. This is X Squared Radio. Joe, I have an observation about this change. A few weeks ago, 6 or 8 weeks ago, I read the Gettysburg Address on this program from the stress point that Lincoln was taking advantage of their first victory in the Civil War. He needed to build support, both economic and political, for the war, which they were losing terribly. 13 states had seceded from the Union. They were trying to get them back in the Union by force. And it wasn't working so well until they won one battle at Gettysburg. And so using the backdrop of the buried dead for this speech, Lincoln gave a dramatically stunning speech, which literally turned the course of the war and has been read in just about every civics class since that time. States' rights are again in the forefront. And in the last couple of years, 26 states have signed what are called sovereignty acts. This is the equivalent of what's called nullification. It means that states have the final review on any federal mandate, that it must be ratified by the state's legislature before it will actually go into force in that state. Now, mind you, this is completely secessionary, okay? This is revolutionary. I mean revolution with a capital R, because seven more states, that is to say, when we 33 states passing these sovereignty acts, and they've been as recent as a month ago, seven more states, we now have enough states to reach the two-thirds ratification point. It means that if those 33 states ask for a constitutional convention, the ratifying force to make any amendment, which is agreed upon by those states, is already there. Now, amendment process of the Constitution through a constitutional convention is a tricky business. It's only been done once. And since the writing of the Constitution, there have only been 17 amendments. That's it. It's a tough process to accomplish. But states are going broke at the rate of about one a quarter. And they're not the small states. They're the big states. And so states' rights are again in the forefront. And it is reaching a point of momentum, a tipping point, where we could literally take control of the bureaucracies, the departments and agencies, which are eating up your tax dollars, by a constitutional convention that is put together from the states up. In other words, it's a new American Civil War, only it's not a war. It is a civil uprising. It is a civil reorganization. And it is scientific because it is pure political science at its greatest. So I would like your thoughts on that, Joe, if you have any.
I'm a huge fan of history. Matter of fact, I just finished reading the Ken Burns edition of Civil War that has the Gettysburg Address in it. And we've all heard it and read it, you know, numerous times in our lifetime. But, yeah, we are facing a new revolution. And it's going to happen first in our minds. And then it will happen very rapidly in the streets. And so that's what we're doing. We're helping you change your mind, and we're helping to empower you by telling you, you know, where to look and how to organize and the things that you need to do. In the process of presenting my ideas for the city of Houston, I ended up meeting for an hour apiece with seven U.S. congressmen, which in addition to Bill Archer was Tom DeLay, Kevin Brady, Jack Field, Sheila Jackson Lee, and Gene Green. I met with four City of Houston mayors, met with dozens of state legislators, all 16 members of the city council, bunch of small town mayors in the area. I met with probably 100 elected politicians. Out of those, I can tell you, when you spend an hour with somebody, you can tell if they're honest. And in that whole bunch. I did go to a Mies Foundation meeting a year and a half ago, and Ron Paul got up and spoke. And in the first 10 minutes, I went, oh, my God, this is the first politician I've ever seen in my life. And he was standing there, 80 years old, a frail doctor that's delivered 5,000 babies, standing on the podium talking to a room of 500 people. And nobody had a screening detector at the front door, so anybody could have walked in, anything could have happened. And I was looking around this room of people, and they were all very, you know, dedicated people, but you never knew if there was a crackpot in the room. And I thought, my God, if a crackpot did jump up and start to do something, this is the only politician I've ever heard in my life that I'd take a bullet for. And there's very few of those people, but we've got to find a lot more of those. And since then, I've gone to a half dozen Tea Party meetings, and I've heard the GOP rhinos come in and put on their Tea Party dresses and start telling you how great they are and how they're listening to you. And as soon as you know, agree that things have to be done the GOP way, they'll support you and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it's just the most disgusting thing. Somehow we've got to throw off this two-party puppet system yoke, because it is doing us no good and it will not carry us to the future. So,
well, I like the thoughts, and I like Ron Paul. I remember when he was asked in the last presidential round of debates in the last election whether or not he thought he was electable. And I thought that his answer to that question posed by the Fox News commentator was noble and powerful, and as impromptu as it was the thought of a pure heart that came forth. The fact that Ron Paul comes down on the right side of every single position, every single policy position that makes up America, without having to think about it, without having to put his finger in the wind, is very encouraging. His son, Rand, when I posed the idea to his office that Kentucky was about to lose 1,200 jobs because our electric car company was going to move to another state because we weren't getting any support from the state, his office called me, and we talked for 40 minutes on the phone. And I thought, you know, I interact with politicians on a fairly regular basis, as you probably do, only from a different standpoint. I do from an industrial standpoint, trying to bring technologies to market. And I've met with lots of congressmen, senators, governors, never a president, but I guess I'm getting pretty close now.
Working your way up.
I'm amazed. I was at the Pentagon this last Wednesday, and some in my organization would rather that I did not say that on this station. But I have to be honest with my listeners. There are members of the Pentagon that are very, very anxious to get these electric vehicles into the economics of transporting things to the federal government. So it's a very, very positive environment, and I think it's going to work out well for us. But there is a gamut, there is a broad range of motivations in politics. It is only when, as Joe says, when you meet with them face to face, off camera, talk to them, shake their hand, you can tell which ones are there and which ones are only there as long as the cameras aren't rolling. If the cameras are rolling, it's a totally different story. It's the ones that are real are the ones we need to put in office. The rest, we need to pull the silver handle and flush them all.
Well, we couldn't be more blessed with what we were given in the way of a nation. And, you know, we've made plenty of mistakes in the past, but there's no reason to throw out the baby with the bathwater. The U.S. Constitution is, if there is a divine document on the planet, it's got to be close to there. And it's just one of the finest things. And if we live by the principles of the Constitution, we'd have none of these problems. It's the distortions and the power grabs that have taken place that have undermined it completely, and they're fully intended to undermine it the rest of the way. I mentioned that one of my articles was One Pleasant Day in Runnymede. I actually saw the only copy of the Magna Carta that's not in restricted view in the British Museum. And it's a very interesting backstory. I was over in England with the love of my life, and we were driving from Stonehenge down to the Isle of Wight. And we had left from close to London earlier in the day, and so it had been a long day's drive, and it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and she said, I'd like to stop for tea. And, you know, there's little places along the road you could stop for tea, and I saw this spire sticking up, and I said, well, why don't we go to the cathedral in this little town, and happened to be Salisbury. And I've been in dozens of European cathedrals, and we pulled up in front of this thing, and I got out of the car, and my jaw dropped. You could hide Notre Dame inside this place. The spire was 400 feet tall. We walk into the nave of the church, and there's a boys' choir that's singing Latin hymns. And it's for rehearsal. This is on a Wednesday afternoon. They're singing Latin hymns for the Sunday service, and they've got a choir director from London who's helping them make sure they get the diction on the Latin correct, because it's not something they typically do. And so they're going over and over these Latin hymns, and you walk up to the first marble crypt, and there's a bishop for that diocese who served from 11 to 1120, and he died, but he's the one that laid the cornerstone for the cathedral. And next to him is a marble crypt for the one that served from 1120 to 1150, and he helped raise the walls. And then you go all the way around this church, and the whole time this choir was singing, it was the most ethereal feeling in the world. And we got finished walking through the whole nave of the church, and I went, boy, that's really interesting. Well, let's go get that cup of tea and clotted cream and scones that you so wanted, you know. And as we're walking down the cloister outside the church to the tea room, there's a little octagon-shaped room off to the side, and there's an old World War II vet standing outside with his medals pinned on and his red beret, and he goes, I bet you come here to see the Magna Carta, didn't you? And I went, the Magna Carta? I said, you gotta be kidding me. He goes, nope, got it right here, come on in. And we walked in, and there was this angled top desk with a quarter inch steel plate on it, and he pulls down a counterlever weight, and this cover lifts up, and here's the Magna Carta. And I'm sitting there looking at it. It's about 18 inches wide and about 30 inches tall. And it's written in the smallest script imaginable. And it's the rules for the King of England to abide by. And down at the bottom, there's a little brown spot that's about an inch and a half in diameter. And he says, you see that spot right there? And I said, yeah. He said, when I was a lad, there was the wax seal. You could see King John on his horse stamped there, he said, but when I went off to war, some missy lifted the glass to clean it, and when she did, it turned to dust and fell away. And I went, my God, this was signed in 1215. It's the only one, and they made the king sign 50 copies, and they put them in every county district in England so that everyone would know what the rules were. And the elite went around destroying them. Cromwell destroyed half of them. They went around destroying everyone they could get their hands on because they didn't want people to have rights, and they didn't want you to know your rights. And the amazing thing was, when we got to the tea room and we sat down and started drinking our tea, I said, this is such an interesting place, I've got to get the traveler's brochure to take back to me to America. And I picked one up, and I was sitting there looking at it, and it says, be sure to see the world's oldest mechanical clock, built in 1420 or something like that. It was in the spire until the 1850s, at which point so many people had pocket watches they decided they didn't need it, and it was just an entrance for rats and birds, and so they took it out of the 400-foot-tall spire. But they have the clock mechanism still hanging in the nave of the church, and I was so consumed with other things I hadn't seen it. So there's a world of mystery. There's a world of knowledge out there, and it's everywhere you look. There's something you can learn every day.
A lot of people don't know. A lot of people don't know that the Magna Carta, which was signed in 1215, was written by Scotsmen. One of my ancestors was one of the craftsmen of the Magna Carta, and it basically makes up the Bill of Rights, which is in the Constitution.
It sets weights and measures standards. It gives women the right to have property. Up until that time, if your husband died, the first man that wasn't married that showed up to your house, he could say, you're marrying me, and a woman had no right. It's like, okay, well, I guess I am, you know? And so she couldn't own property. If she didn't marry the first guy, the second guy could be worse. And so, you know, basically, it instilled a whole wide range of rights that now you wouldn't even consider. But these people were under such oppression that they finally gathered against the king on the plains outside of Windsor, and they said, you're going to sign this or you're going to die. And the monarchs reluctantly signed it, and then they've reluctantly enforced it selectively whenever they could and tried it the best they could to destroy it and obliterate any thoughts or mention of it. But it's an extremely wonderful document. It's, you know, there again, you've got the world's greatest library sitting on your desktop. Just go pick up your mouse and go to search engine and put in Magna Carta and start reading some of these things. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. The language will be very familiar to you when you read the Magna Carta and you see, you know, what was done to get the king to sign that. And then 500 years later, the language resurfaces in a little bit more modern tongue as the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights.
And there again, what caused the Declaration of Independence was the Gutenberg printing press, which was developed in the 1500s. That's what caused the Reformation. That's what caused the Renaissance. And the American Revolution was just the final extension. What we saw with the fall of the Berlin Wall that took just weeks to travel all the way across from Eastern Europe all the way over to China took hundreds of years to happen during the time of Copernicus and Galileo and Gutenberg and Martin Luther and the other minds that changed reality at that time and created the seeds for the American Revolution. And the American Revolution was just an application of the scientific method, which was developed in the 1660s. The Royal Society was actually formed in 1661. And so this was the gestation period for that particular time frame because of the limits of communication and the level of ignorance that they were having to overcome. Now the communication is virtually instantaneous, and so all we've got to do is overcome our ignorance. And then we can have a very rapid change that will be extremely powerful for all of us. And I see...
And it can happen very fast. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Internet really has only been effective in this country for 15 years. Less than 15 years is when high-speed Internet started getting available for most households. It wasn't until cable Internet started to get into the households and these high-speed modems allowed people to actually surf the net. And since then, we now have gone from PDAs to smartphones. That's only happened in the last couple of years. And we've had social networks like Facebook, Twitter, and there are others that are now coming up that are even more efficient and more targeted that are facilitating the overthrow of tyrants country after country after country. And it's happening real time while we're watching it on the news.
And a certain number of those are color revolutions that are being funded and orchestrated by the monopolists, but they're not going the way they want them to. They've lost control of the direction. Just like that happened with Hitler. They set Hitler up to do certain things, and most of that was to conquer Eastern Europe and attack Russia, and it didn't happen the way they wanted him to. Once he got enough power, he became uncontrollable, and then he turned on Western Europe and started attacking England and drug them into a war that they hadn't anticipated was going to happen. And so that's where we are on that front also. They've created these color revolutions in some of these countries because they want to overtake them and take the assets, but now they've lost control of the revolutions because people in these countries actually understand the subtleties of democracy and the benefits, and they want those. And so now they're faced with the dilemma of how do you control a revolution that's not going the direction you want. And
well, where do you see it going? I mean, I think Libya's in its final death throes as we speak. Where do you see Saudi Arabia going? Where do you see Qatar and some of these other nations that are ruled by, shall I call it, asset-grabbing royals, while the people live in squalor? And by the way, those of you that have been to Egypt before know this. I've told you about it several times, where you have this upper class that lives in an aristocratic porcelain-covered life, and the vast majority of Egyptians live without clean water, traffic management, apartments to live in. They have no resources, no educational system. You know, a modern city like Cairo, 20 million people living in it, and there isn't a single traffic light. This is, and yet the government absconds with tens of billions of dollars every single year, not only in income to the country, but in foreign aid, and basically just makes themselves rich and puts their money in other countries' holdings, like gold and diamonds and properties around the world, and the people just got tired of it. So where do you see this going with countries like Saudi Arabia?
Well, interesting that you mentioned that. I went to Egypt in 2000 in February and went from Abu Simbel on Lake Aswan, all across Lake Aswan, and then down the Nile River to Karnak and Luxor, and then flew into Giza and went out to Socorro. So I spent 3 weeks going through Egypt, and I had the same impression of it. It's the two-tiered caste system that the elites so love. It's them as lords and everyone else as serfs. And that's what the Magna Carta was opposed to, and that's what gave birth to the Industrial Revolution, was being able to take things out of control of this small group of people. And we're facing a new revolution where humanity will become far more productive once we overthrow this yoke. And I think
do you see that energy of destabilization and of civil unrest expanding into the more solid and shall I call it more a key American ally countries like Saudi Arabia?
Oh yeah, they're gonna go ahead and overthrow Saudi House of Lords because they want to fractionalize that country and take over their assets. And so they've played a dirty game with these people for a long time, where we won't drill our oil and we'll provide you oil and we'll let you manipulate the markets and blah 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 blah, but they haven't been able to create a just society. So there is an enormous amount of unrest throughout the Middle East. Like I said, I've only been there for 3 weeks, and that was in 2000, and that was in Egypt, but it's palpatory. You can sense, even then I could sense that the people were very, very unhappy and that the system was grossly unjust and that the people were very aware of it. You know, and you have another...
Well, I was in Egypt 12 weeks before the revolution. Hmm. And some of my friends communicating with me by email were there on the streets while it was going on. And what we're hearing on the news was completely different than what was going on in the streets.
I had a neighbor that was there doing missionary work, and he said he was lucky to get out. He said, man, he really fears for all of the people over there that are Christians. The cops in particular are really subject to abuse over there. So I don't know. There again, it's speculation, and I'm better off if we talk about science and empirical stuff or the history that I've studied than I am projecting.
It
can be a visionary or futurist about a lot of things, but when it involves negativity and involves regions of the world that you haven't visited, then it becomes more and more speculative. So
I understand.
I'm optimistic that there's plenty of people in the world that are tuned into the same human conscience that you and I are resonating with, and that they are approachable from that particular standpoint and may not even know it. So what I think is capable is that we are capable of changing the world on a subconscious basis without them even knowing it, and we'll all end up in an Eden that we had no way of predicting in a far shorter period of time than we thought possible. So that's where I'm operating from.
Do you think the engineering community is being inspired in the right direction by becoming more green, by becoming more sustainable, by becoming more environmentally friendly? And I'm using those buzzwords on purpose. What I mean is that we adopt the idea that we are living more in harmony with the environment, and we're not so poisonous as members of the species of this planet.
Well, my feeling, and I'm very connected with the engineering community, past president of a local engineering society and involved with a lot of different engineers, and all of them are very conscious about it. The problem is that they've been fed this government dogma, and they're having struggles with that. One of the groups is American Society of Heating, Ventilating, and Refrigeration Engineers. The report is ASHRAE. Yeah, and I wrote an article called Airmen of ASHRAE Enter the Fray, and I sent it to probably 50 different offices. They've got 200 local chapters worldwide, but most of them are in the United States. I sent it to 50 of the presidents, vice presidents, and other executives at their offices. They're again showing the power of the internet. You get online, you find out the names of the chapters, you get the presidents, and I did the same thing with 200 college professors when I wrote my Nullius in Verba article in England. I got online and emailed it. You don't know that they're going to all open it, but surprisingly enough, you get a response from 10%, which tells you that at least 10% opened them. And so out of the 200 I sent to ASHRAE officers in the United States, I got 20 replies back saying, oh, man, great article. And you know that once you've made a connection with that person, that there is a person who has a local connection to other people and can share your information if they want. So you figure from that point you may have a tenfold increase in your productivity from that standpoint. And so basically you've got a force multiplier sitting there on your desk also. Every person you email has the potential of emailing another 10 people. Every person that hears this podcast or radio broadcast today is going to go, that made me start thinking about a whole lot of things, and I'm going to share some stuff with somebody else. And that's how we will collectively unite the human conscience, and we will raise the human conscience, and we will rid ourselves of this yoke that's been placed upon us, and we'll remove the blinders from our eyes, and at which point we'll have a vastly more productive reality for all of us to deal with. So,
well, and those are general terms, but in reality it means that bad scientific legislation will stop making it into law. For instance, the very myth that we started the program out with, that that there's going to be a carbon tax, that we're going to stop the production of CO2, that's what's actually warming the planet and putting the planet in danger of overheating. This is bad science. This is really bad science, upon which is based legislation, which is having sweeping economic effects upon our society and others. And I really have a hard time struggling with the departments, the agencies, and the bureaus that are consuming the bulk of the tax money that we are generating based upon things like this bad science.
Well, the funding for climate research under Ronald Reagan was $20 million a year. When George Bush took office, he raised that to $2 billion per year, and every bit of that increase was for carbon endangerment findings. And like I mentioned in one of my articles, if all you fund is findings for danger, danger is all you will find. And we have consumed over $100 billion of our tax money to create this false science. We all inhale 380 parts per million of carbon dioxide. We all exhale 40,000 parts per million of carbon dioxide. When they couldn't get the legislature to pass the carbon cap and trade Waxman-Markey bill, they went to the courts, and five of the nine Supreme Court justices said, well, the EPA would never lie, so if they say something, it must be correct. Well, here's five individuals who were appointed for life who could not pass a high school science exam, who have just made a ruling in favor of taxing and destroying American industry based on a lie that's cost us $100 billion just to create and will cost us $1 trillion a year to sustain. It's absolute insanity.
And it's created an industry of brokerage now that is now exchanging the currency of carbon credits, which
well,
have
this
become
time
money.
Last year, carbon credits were selling for $100 a ton, but because of the disclosure of ClimateGate in November of 2009, and because of the attack by so many principled scientists worldwide and so many legislators that are starting to get pressure from the public, and believe me, they only respond to pressure. If the pressure is from government funding to create a larger bureaucracy, they'll go with that. If they get pressure from the general population that's going, wait a minute, the government funding is for a lie and we don't need this, then they'll respond to that pressure, and they have. And that's why they had to resort to the Supreme Court rulings to get the most draconian of their measures passed. It's absolutely absurd. Again, I want to mention that I've got a great interview with Dennis Miller that was on 293 radio stations. The audio and transcript are posted at my publisher's website for Slaying the Skydragger, and that publisher is StairwayPress.com. And if you go on to StairwayPress.com, put in Joe Olson, Dennis Miller interview, and it's embedded. You can punch play and listen to the interview while you read the transcripts below it, and it's very easy to follow along with the numbers that way. And this gives you a 10-minute, very humorous, very informed rebuttal on three of the main things about this global warming lie. And this is the most easily defeatable lie, and this will be the Waterloo for the monopolists. And this is the one we need to press on most, is overcoming this global warming fraud. And once we do that, then we will demonstrate to everyone that yes, it is possible for the government to lie to you. And not only have they been lying about this, they've been lying about peak oil, they've been lying about Big Bang, they've been lying about nuclear energy safety, they've been lying about green energy, and we can just overturn this whole realm of things. We'll force them to sign a Magna Carta like they never dreamed. So.
Well, that's good. And that's why we like to have great minds like yours on X Squared Radio. It's why we like exploring the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. And I cannot believe this, but 3 hours have gone by already.
Oh, Brooks, this has been absolute blast. We've got to do this again sometime.
Yeah, we absolutely do. I totally agree. When Joe and I were
exchanging more emails. I've got a sir?
No, I was going to say, when we were exchanging emails, we knew that this was going to be a great broadcast because there was so much synergy and there was so much good communication going on, but I had no idea that it would be this good. This has really been great.
I thought we'd do an hour and then it'd be, well, okay, fine. I'll, you know, talk to you later. But once we got started talking, there was no reason to stop. And I certainly appreciate it. I hope your listeners have enjoyed it. And I hope they'll do everything they can to share this with others. If they've got to turn them on to the podcast, it's like, hey, this is something you need to spend a little bit of time listening to. And please, take notes and go to the websites that Brooks and I have recommended you go to and read the articles because we're trying to point out truth to you, and truth is universal. Truth is empirical. Truth is, you'll know it when you see it. You'll feel it. You'll be able to share it with others, and you will have no reason to argue about it. It's like, this is the truth, and, you know, too bad if you don't agree with it. It's your dogma that got run over by our karma. So, anyhow.
When you hear the prospective candidates talk about it in the next 18 months, you will know, because now you've been empowered by the knowledge that you received here tonight on X Squared Radio. Joe, thank you so much for being part of the program. We will communicate very shortly. I'll give you the links to the broadcast tonight, and we'll make sure that all the websites that you mentioned tonight are linked on our website, so that listeners that wake up tomorrow morning and go to work and open this at their workstations and listen can then go to those sites as well.
Bless you, Brooks, and the truth will prevail. Like they say, veritas vos liberat.
Veritas indeed. Thank you very much, sir.
The truth will set you free, the call of the French Revolution. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you very much. Have a great week.
Yes, sir. I will. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, Earth Explorers, that is it for May 1st, 2011, X Squared Radio. I was your host, Brooks Agnew. My guest was Joe Olson. You can go to xsquaredradio.com. And we will post a link to this. Obviously, I did not record tonight because I have a steering wheel in my hand instead of a mixing board. And this has been Stories from the Road with X Squared Radio. We'll provide a link to the BBS radio version of this, and you will have access to it immediately. So thank you very much, and we will see you next week. This is Brooks Agnew signing off with X Squared Radio.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.